You have one lawyer that you can call. It's not how many lawyers they have, it's how many floors of lawyers they have.
Welcome to Off the Chart with Medical Economics, a podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors and medical practices. I'm your host, Keith Reynolds, and today we feature an interview between Medical Economics Managing Editor Todd Shryock and Scott Dewey, Chief Managed Care Officer at Pear Health. I hope you're strapped in because they're digging deep into the best tips and tricks for payer negotiations.
All right, I'm here with Scott Dewey of Payer Health to talk about negotiating with payers. Scott, how are you today?
Good afternoon. I'm doing great.
Great, thanks for joining me. So when physicians are entering into payer negotiations, where should their preparations start and maybe when should their preparations start?
Well, the easy answer to that is you always start with a strategy. The worst thing you can do is become reactive. The payers have a game plan it's well defined and well practiced, and it's set up according to rules they've designed. So you want to think things through. You want to know your strengths. You want to identify what leverage opportunities you've got. You want to know the payers' vulnerabilities. Believe it or not, payers do have vulnerabilities. Knowing the payer's motivations is really important. What are they working on? Are they introducing new products? Are they doing a service area expansion and they really need you for this product? Even though you're talking about maybe a commercial product, maybe they've decided to get into the exchange or they're bidding on a Medicaid product. They might need you for that product, and you can use that to your advantage when you're talking about the commercial product, which might be the provider's goal. There are network adequacy standards specifically for Medicare Advantage, but other products as well. There may be key employers, especially the big ones that they already have or they're trying to bid on. Having network disruption at a key time is very damaging to them, and they really want to avoid that. They may be very focused on value-based care. And knowing what your advantages, what you bring to the table, can be an important part of that conversation. Market share is another good component. And that applies to your market share as a provider and to their market share as a payer. And you can still use that to your advantage. If you're the big fish, great, you've got leverage. If you're the small fish, you want to tell them you're trying to preserve competition. The worst thing that can happen in their mind is consolidation on the provider side. If you go out of business or get bought by the big fish, all of a sudden their job gets a lot harder and their costs go up. So it's really in their best interest to keep you viable as a provider, to keep you competitive, and you can frame the debate in that way. Part of your strategy also should be to know what your secondary asks are. The primary almost always is, it's about the money, right? But sometimes you're not gonna get what you wanted. There are still wins that you can get out of it that aren't necessarily tied to what is the negotiated reimbursement rate. That can be contract language, it can be operational concerns. There's other ways to come out with a win.
How far in advance should you start preparing for the negotiation if you're a provider?
That is a good question. And the answer, as many times it is in healthcare, is it depends. depending on the situation, depending on your leverage, depending on the product, knowing the calendar is honestly really important. Knowing when open enrollment is and kind of backing up the calendar from there can, you know, really put you in a much more advantageous spot. So the last thing you want to do is wait till the last minute, of course. So again, as part of your strategy, know what the termination clause might be, know what the notification clause, how many, you know, months, weeks, sometimes years in advance, you need to notify them of your intent to renegotiate. These are all considerations that go into that strategy.
Physicians obviously don't enjoy negotiations. They want to practice medicine. But the temptation would be to take a longer contract. Is it if it's offered, is a longer contract better than a shorter one?
Unless you have a really favorable contract that you want to lock in for long term, shorter is better. I prefer 1 year. Things change frequently. The payers want to lock you into long term contracts where they can dictate the terms, but doing that prevents you from being able to renegotiate when things change. Market conditions change, competitive conditions change. Fee schedules can be changed. Technology changes. Things, that used to cost. I hear this so many times that this supply, whatever it is, used to cost me this, and now it costs not 20% more, it costs three, four, five times more. And all of a sudden, that contract that I signed 3 years ago, which was fine, I'm losing money on every patient that I see. If you're locked into a long-term contract, there's nothing you can do about it. And they're not going to give you any relief until they have to, based on the contract. There can also be, regulatory changes that change the dynamic. All that to say, if you are on, once a year, I think you should be able to assess and talk about terms with the payer.
So many of these payers are multi-billion-dollar companies with, a small army of lawyers to help them negotiate, all kinds of expertise. How much negotiating room does a smaller medical practice really have with these corporate giants?
And you're right. I've used that vision before, that visual, to say you have one lawyer that you can call. It's not how many lawyers they have, it's how many floors of lawyers they have. And I'm not kidding when I say that. There are literally, just cubicles, and offices on multiple floors, all with a very specific focus. So you're right. The deck is clearly stacked against the providers. Their pockets are way deeper than any providers are going to be. But contract negotiations, it's a leverage game. And even small providers, you can identify a leverage point potentially that can alter that power dynamic. Maybe you provide a unique service. There are a number of providers that don't realize that a service they provide is really critical because CMS requires them to have, for this population, you need three of, fill in the blank. Or even a part of their practice. Pediatrics is a struggle sometimes for payers when they're putting together their network adequacy documents. And the fact that a practice says, oh, yeah, by the way, we also serve child and adolescent patients as part of our practice. It's not the majority, but we can. That can be a game changer in the conversation.
Oh, you say you're a practice leader or administrator? We've got just the thing. Our sister site, physicianspractice.com, your one-stop shop for all the expert tips and tricks that will get your practice really humming. Again, that's physicianspractice.com.
I've heard some practices say, I can't negotiate. They just give me a contract and they say, take it or leave it. Do you have any advice for them? Is there any way to get around that?
I cannot tell you the number of times I've gotten a proposal that's best and final, or even this contract is not negotiable. Things are not negotiable until the payer is persuaded that, hey, the negotiation that we're or the deal that we're offering you is in your best interest. Sort of reframing the discussion to show the payer, hey, what I'm talking to you about, what my practice brings to the table, this proposal I'm bringing you. It's actually in your best interest. It's going to lower your overall cost. It's going to change your ER rate. Something that we're that reframing that. It's miraculous how these are not negotiable become negotiable when it's in their interest.
What about prior authorizations? Those have become the bane of so many
Oh, yeah.
physicians and patients alike. Is that something you can negotiate some sort of limitation into in a contract?
Sure. Even with massive amounts of leverage. You're never going to get it removed. That's the payer's bread and butter. They've told their customers, and they have customers, right? They have employers, they have the federal and they have the state government. We're watching the store. We're not just going to pay any claim that comes through. We're only going to pay things that are medically necessary. And they have a justifiable obligation to say, let's take a look at this before we pay the claim or before we authorize it. And the authorization process prior to, but sometimes after the fact, is the way to do that. With that said, you're not going to get rid of it, but you can add some guardrails around things like turnaround times. If you ask for an authorization and they take weeks to do it, it's bad for patient care. It's just bad all the way around. Hold them accountable for a reasonable turnaround time to at least get you an answer. There are things like peer-to-peer review. If the provider disagrees with the decision, third-party reviews to that you can appeal an adverse decision to, allowing for medical necessity appeals if the authorization wasn't obtained prior to the service, which isn't always possible, of course. You don't want them to make a decision that's what I call administrative only. Well, you failed to do this administrative thing, therefore we're just going to deny it. We're not even going to look at it. Require them to make that decision based on medical necessity criteria. Retrospective denials is something I like to put in my contracts to prohibit what I call Monday morning quarterbacking. You can't authorize a service, you provide the service, and then they look at it and decide it wasn't medically necessary. That's just not acceptable. So you can add these things to your contracts. And there's one other way, which I honestly think is the best way, and it's more process driven, and that's what's called gold carding, I think, if you've heard the term. Most payers have some version of that you can demonstrate your denial rate for my practice, for my hospital, is very low. It's less than 5%, it's less than 10%. And it is, if they can verify that, then they will quote unquote turn off prior authorization for your practice, for your tax ID number.
How common is it for payers to have contract language about being able to unilaterally amend a contract? And should a payer ever be allowed to do this?
Oh, unilateral amendments are absolutely standard boilerplate language now. And the payer will assert that they have to have this so that everybody is treated, the same, and that's how they maintain regulatory compliance. They'll claim, they'll play the victim and say, we couldn't possibly administer our health plan unless we can change your contract. And you can concede for regulatory limit that language. Okay, you can unilaterally amend solely to comply with applicable regulations. But beyond that, mutual written agreement is going to be required. And remember, payers can change things unilaterally in ways that aren't just contract language. They can change, they can and do change all the time their policies and procedures. At least make sure that you have in the contract that they're required to notify you of those changes. I see language all the time that provider shall comply with policies and procedures that they know or should have known. I love that one. Make sure that they notify you too. So you're in a position to assess and challenge them on those changes because they can be onerous. And if you challenge them, if enough people challenge them, you can get them to back down or at least talk to you about alternatives.
What are some common contract mistakes you see physicians agree to?
Boilerplate languages, the ones that they send out, are just chock full of language that's completely one-sided toward the payer. If there's a restriction on the provider, then you should ask the payer to abide by the same terms. If they have a time limit for you to contest underpaid claims of 6 months, then the payer shouldn't be able to recoup an overpaid claim for the same time period. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. And I've had some pretty good luck, making that case that let's agree on a time period we can both live with after which we both get to close our books and move on, instead of years after the fact, somebody coming back and pulling that back. Does the provider have an obligation to get the claim in timely? Sure, but there are extenuating circumstances that are beyond the provider's control that can be noted in the contract. If there's a timely filing limit, the payer should have a prompt pay timeframe as well. Things like that. Defined fee schedules. That's another bugaboo. The quote unquote, fill in the payer's name, market fee schedule. That means they can decide what that is, and they can decide that it's 20% less than it was yesterday. I like to tie things to a third-party fee schedule. Medicare allowable is a common one. That's not to say that Medicare doesn't make changes, but they tend to be less arbitrary, I'd say. And of course, like we talked about earlier, rates are—they're not the only important part of the contract. Language is important too. So a common mistake is to say, "Oh, I got that fee schedule I wanted, but I didn't fully read all that language in there." And they give with one hand the fee schedule, and they take away with the other hand based on administrative policy.
Say, Keith, this is all well and good, but what if someone is looking for more clinical information?
Oh, then they want to check out our sister site, patientcareonline.com, the leading clinical resource for primary care physicians. Again, that's patientcareonline.com.
With so many contracts leaning more into value-based care, is there anything different about a value-based care contract that physicians need to be aware of compared to a traditional fee-for-service?
Oh, absolutely. And value-based contracts, that's just become such a generic catch-all term for, a whole array of programs ranging from what I call non-contractual programs, where you just sign up for it. You're not negotiating or signing an agreement. It's just available to you. If you do this, fill out this form, close this care gap, we will provide this financial reward. And those are great programs, by the way. There's usually no risk associated with them, so absolutely take advantage of those. All the way up to, population management arrangements, where large provider groups, integrated delivery systems, agree to take financial responsibility for the total medical spend for a large cohort of patients. So, each of those, and from those extremes in the middle, pay attention. There's a lot of revenue associated for it, and a lot of these programs are certainly designed in ways that do benefit the patients and do change, bend that cost curve while improving outcomes. But there are also plenty of metrics that they will call quality, but really are about saving the payer money as opposed to improving outcomes. Formulary compliance, that's purely a financial consideration, not a quality one. Where the metrics that have been chosen and the targets that you have to achieve under those metrics, that's definitely something to pay close attention to. Many of them, quite honestly, I believe are set too high. They're based on CMS scores for star scores and five star. That's a great goal to have. It takes time and expertise to get there. You can many times negotiate which metrics you're going to be judged on or held accountable for to get that reward, and where the targets are. If five star is 90% and you're at 50%, that's such a big leap in the first year. Many providers will just shrug their shoulders and say, well, why bother trying? I'm never going to get there. So you can negotiate, kind of a tiered approach. Hey, in the first year, I'll get to 60, second year, 70, over a period of years. Yeah, let's get to 90. All these things are potentially negotiable, but yeah, you have to read the programs. You have to get to know the details. One last point on that too. Many contracts allow the payer to change those targets, to change those goals mid-program year, which is completely unfair. If you've established the goalpost, you don't get to move the goalpost.
Is there anything else physicians need to know about contracts?
I would say get it in writing. Make sure it's in the contract. Many times you'll be assured, oh, no, we never do that, or we always do that, or our policies and procedures say that. At the end of the day, verbal assurances, emails that reassured you of things, these have no legal force. It's all about what the contract says. To protect yourself, if it's important to you, if it's important to your practice, your facility, make sure you get it in the contract. I'm trying to think. Payers are always updating their contracts and adding language that benefits them and restricts the providers. So just don't assume that this new version of the contract or the renewal document is the same. Payers will sneak in, you can call them Easter eggs, you can call them trapdoors, you can call them landmines. and sometimes it's only one line that got added, but it may be significant. All that to say, read every line, don't assume. There's another new one that I'm seeing a lot in payer contracts, and that's the payer's effort to address consolidation now that they've consolidated on the payer side. They're very big and very powerful. Making sure that the providers can't do that as well is something that they're putting into the contracts now. Restrictions on any change to the nature of your practice, your facility, so that if you merge with or add or acquire or are acquired by, the payer has the right to say if both parties had contracts at different terms, we, the payer, get to decide which one to pay you under. I would highly, heavily advise resistance to that.
Great. Scott, thanks for joining me today.
It was my pleasure. Good to talk to you, Todd.
Again, that was Medical Economics Managing Editor Todd Stryuck and Scott Dewey, Chief Managed Care Officer at Payer Health. My name is Keith Reynolds, and on behalf of the whole Medical Economics team, I'd like to thank you for listening and ask that you please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, if you'd like a digest of the best stories Medical Economics publishes delivered straight to your email 6 days a week, subscribe to our newsletter at medicaleconomics.com. Thanks!